Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Tuesday, March 4th. Operation Hire Hawaii, the move to hire displaced federal workers, kicked off on Friday and drew hundreds to its first job fair, close to 1,000 applicants. C-Spot run, C-Spot not run. We get an update from Honolulu Civil Beat on that robotic dog paid for by taxpayers years ago. Is Spot in the doghouse? Today is a key internal deadline for bills at the halfway point at the legislature. We get an update on the art scene. Plus, a poet takes the stage at the Blue Note and talks about laughing through hard times. And 40 years strong, a kumuhula gets ready to celebrate the milestone and stays busier than ever. You're tuned to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. 827 applications. That's how many the state has received as part of Operation Hire Hawaii. Governor Josh Green issued an emergency proclamation to tap into the pool of laid-off federal workers and fill more than 4,000 open positions in state government. So far, several job offers have already been extended, and there are 42 open positions. The Conversation's D.W. Gibson spoke with the state's Director of Human Resources, Brenna Hashimoto, about how Operation Hire Hawaii fast-tracks the process.
Governor Green issued an emergency proclamation in response to what's been happening at the federal level with federal funding and the loss of positions and resignations, and also the indirect impact on the private sector who relies on federal funds. And so when we were contemplating what was happening and seeing how we could take care of the residents of Hawaii, we immediately thought, let's try to get them into our state vacancies. The state has about 17,000 civil service positions statewide, and we have about 4,000 of those that are vacant. So there's a real need within state government for experienced, knowledgeable, dedicated civil servants in our ranks. And so it was a real opportunity for us to not only fill our jobs, but also take care of those who are negatively impacted, often without much notice, and make sure that they have, you know, a place to land and opportunities.
Those are big numbers in terms of vacancies. Tell us about some of the spaces or departments where those vacancies are most pronounced.
I think if you were to ask my colleagues, the other directors, everyone is struggling with filling vacancies. And it really follows along what's been happening over the last several years. And in fact, a decade or so, we've seen the numbers of vacancies within state government climb pretty steadily since around 2015. Since around 2015, that number has gone from about 16% up until around 2023. It climbed to a high of 27%, which is for small departments and trying to get work done. If you're faced with a 27% vacancy rate, it really cripples your ability to meet the needs of our community. So it's been something that's been on top of mind for not only my colleagues, but also the legislature. It's no secret that Hawaii is a tight labor market. We're a small state. We have, you know, geographic challenges trying to recruit. And so providing opportunities and filling jobs has always been a real challenge for us. And so it just seemed natural that we see all of these very qualified individuals losing jobs, and yet we have this great demand. So we're trying to make lemonade out of some lemons. So Governor Green, you know, his executive order really emphasizes and provides a focused energy from all of the directors to make hiring a priority. And by doing that, he wants us to be able to hire individuals within 14 days. And to us, we provided a process that would allow for that. So it starts with the application. We consider that day one when an applicant submits an application, and we immediately turn those around the next business day to the department, and then we let them run with it. They get all the applications. We don't cull them. We send all the applications out to departments for those jobs that they're interested in using this process to hire. And it's really a full range of jobs, everything from clerical, technical, professional jobs, really the full gamut. So there's really an opportunity for everyone at every level, whether you're starting your career or whether you're a very seasoned, experienced worker, we have an opportunity for you under this OHI project. Really, it's allowing the departments to control part of the process and really empowering them to reach out to candidates within 2 or 3 days of receiving that application. They have just a short window to schedule an interview, and then we would like them to be able to make a conditional job offer within that 2-week period. So for us, that means within 10 business days to meet Governor Green's challenge to us. And so we provided them a process that they can do that.
And you've already put out a call for some positions and had some responses. Tell us about how it's been going in the early days here.
Right. So initially, we reached out to the other directors to ask them to identify their top 3 to 5 priority jobs that we could try to get out and recruiting for immediately. So we got a great response. We got about 90 different classes of work or jobs that they wanted to highlight through this process. And so we've been posting those regularly. So every day we post new jobs. So even if you don't see something today that interests you, please check back. We have jobs posted daily. We turn the applications that we receive around very quickly. To date, we've received over 540 applications for just jobs that we posted thus far. We still have more jobs to post. And then as we fill things, we will be moving on to maybe their next level of priority. We ask them for the initial 3 to 5, but we know that the need is much greater than that. So our plan is to keep posting jobs and keep filling them as quickly as we can. And once certain jobs are filled, then we'll move on to the next.
14 days. It sounds very ambitious, right? Are there tools you've been able to put in place to help speed that process along and meet that goal?
Yes, it's very ambitious. I'm sure it's no secret to anybody that state government doesn't necessarily move that quickly typically, but we're all committed to making it work. And part of that is that we're doing what would typically take weeks or months to accomplish. For example, just screening each and every individual application for minimum qualification requirements. We do that at the point that they want to select somebody. So we don't hold up sending the applications out by screening them in advance. We just send them out as is. We let the department see all the applications. They can do some pre-screening as well and determine who they believe is most qualified or most best fit suited for their position. And then we do a final check of their qualifications before we make that conditional job offer. So rather than screening, 500 applications, we're just screening ones and twos as they're ready to make a hiring decision or an extended job offer.
And I know to help your efforts, you've set up some job fairs, including one that happened last Friday. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. So the Department of Labor and Industrial Relations, which is a partner in obviously trying to find jobs for individuals who are looking for employment, they conducted a job fair to recruit for their positions this past Friday. And our department, DHERD, was also a participant. So we were there to represent the other state departments that weren't able to attend in person to help navigate and help them with applying and submitting their application through our website. Sometimes that can be a challenge for folks who are not familiar. So we have several job fair events coming up, and we'll be available to help anybody who needs help with applying or just wants to learn more about our jobs or has a particular interest and doesn't know where to start.
I know Mayor Blangiardi has put out his own signal to do some hiring for the city and the county as well, reaching out to some of the workers that have lost their jobs. Is there some coordination going on between the state and the city in terms of hiring efforts?
We're typically, operate independently of one another. However, when it comes to things like job fairs, we do try to collaborate. I think it's healthy when there's a good representation from all of our government entities, including the judiciary and the Department of Education, and the city and county. So we have scheduled a job fair for April 11th and 12th at the Convention Center, and we've invited all of those jurisdictions, including the city and county, to come and participate. So the idea is that individuals who are looking to make government their next career, it's sort of a one-stop shop. You can investigate jobs within the state or the county or the judiciary or the other jurisdictions that will be represented.
And how about our listeners on neighbor islands? Talk to us about efforts you've had on neighbor islands and any others that might be coming up.
So in addition to the jobs that we're recruiting specifically through the Operation Hire Hawaii banner, which listeners can find out more information on our website, we do have over 500 other positions that are announced regularly on our website. So at any given time, we have about 500 jobs that are posted and we're taking applications for, many of which are on the neighbor islands. So we have the ability to search on our website. If you're looking for jobs, say, for example, on the Big Island, you can filter just for the Big Island or for Maui. Maui or for Kauai. We recently did a job fair a couple weeks ago on the island of Hawaii and got a lot of interest. And folks were actually mentioning Operation Hire Hawaii, so they had heard about it, which was great. And we continue to post jobs for the neighbor islands as well.
You've mentioned coordinating between so many different departments, right, that are looking to do hiring. And I wonder if you could just maybe even paint a picture for listeners in terms of what it means to all of us as residents of this state, what it means to have a full workforce doing the work that the state needs done.
Well, it really means that we can accomplish our goals. It's really challenging to meet the needs of our community when you're short-staffed. Folks take on more than they should, and oftentimes that leads to burnout or to inefficiencies. So to have a complement of staff that can really cohesively work together and move Governor Green's agenda is what we're all striving for in the administration. And we want to be able to deliver good services and meet the needs of our community.
I have a feeling a few listeners could relate to being stretched thin at work.
Yes, yes. It's been a long, hard row since COVID, and we're making progress. Our vacancy numbers have come down in the last year, but there's still a lot of work to do.
So is there anything else about the efforts you're putting forward to do the hiring that I haven't asked about that you'd want listeners to know about?
I think most importantly, we want good people who want to make a difference in their community to come and join the state. I think it's a great place to work. We offer great pay. We have excellent benefits, and there's a lot of flexibility. We've been hearing about, you know, certain areas of industry and government that are pulling back on flexible work options. And the state does have, we have not only flex schedules, but we have alternate work arrangements, and we do offer remote work after an individual passes their initial probationary period. So I think folks who are looking to make a career change should definitely look at our jobs on our website and come to one of our job fairs.
Well, thank you for coming out and talking to us about the efforts today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Brenna Hashimoto, the director of the Department of Human Resources for the state. She was talking with the Conversation's D.W. Gibson about Operation Hire Hawaii and the state's efforts to fill job vacancies. New opportunities are posted each day, and there will be additional job fairs on April 11th and 12th at the Hawaii Convention Center.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Punahou School, a K-12 community that is dedicated to preparing students for the opportunities and challenges of a changing world. Learn more at punahou.edu.
Calling Hawaii college students. Want a taste of what it's like to work in radio? Thinking about becoming a content creator or pursuing a career in live event production? Hawaii Public Radio is offering a summer internship in collaboration with Kamehameha Schools. For more information, visit hawaiipublicradio.org/jobs.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA. For over 85 years, committed to working together with employers, partners, and healthcare providers to support the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
This morning, we have a story about Spot. And if you recall, Spot is a robotic dog that the Honolulu Police Department purchased many years ago. Here to talk about this is Honolulu Civil Beat's Christina Jedra. Good morning, Christina.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
Yes. So what's the latest on our friend Spot?
So unfortunately, Spot is playing dead. Spot the robot dog is not in use by the Honolulu Police Department, even though it was purchased for $150,000 several years ago. In the early days of Spot's purchase, the police were using it to take the temperatures of homeless people at the police-run homeless encampment program they were running at the time. But that was back in 2021. Fast forward several years now, Spot is just kind of laying dormant at the department. The IT division is assessing it for some potential future use, perhaps searches or surveillance of some kind. But again, it's not being put to any practical use for the residents of Honolulu at this time.
And it was being used to check, what, temperatures of the homeless people at one point?
Right, exactly. So the police were running sort of like a tent city for homeless, unsheltered folks. And of course, this was during COVID, so they were trying to reduce contact, you know, with everybody and have everyone social distance. So the robot was sort of going from tent to tent, taking temperatures. Truly one of the more expensive thermometers in the world, this being $150,000. But, you know, that's the justification they made for using COVID relief money to purchase it. And at the time, the police defended the purchase saying, you know, this is what we're using it for now, but the opportunities are endless for future use after the pandemic. And so I remembered that, and I kind of wanted to check in now that it's been some time and say, you know, have they used it for anything post-COVID? And unfortunately not.
Well, what does the police department say about the status at this point? Have they just retired him altogether?
Well, they're just looking at the possibilities. But, I mean, they have been for some time now kind of thinking of what to do with it. It kind of seems like they don't know what to do with it at this point. So if anyone has any ideas, feel free to suggest them to HPD. One community member I spoke with that maybe could, you know, patrol some of the parks at night, that might be a little dicey, you know, monitor businesses for smash and grabs. But, you know, potentially other cities have used it in like a SWAT team situation. So going into like an active shooter situation that, you know, it would be obviously riskier for a human to go into. But yeah, at this time, Honolulu hasn't put it to use in that way.
Yeah, I mean, I can see if maybe they were doing some investigation with fireworks and...
Who knows?
Yeah, that maybe they could deploy it in that type of situation. But yeah, it is interesting. I mean, it certainly did raise some eyebrows, you know. I mean, it was a novel thing.
It did. It really attracted a lot of criticism, too, when it was first purchased, because this was at a time when people were struggling. People had lost their jobs. The city was kind of botching the rollout of rental relief, so people couldn't pay their rent. We're trying to get some of these federal dollars through the city to, you know, keep their housing, keep their childcare, buy food. This was a time when people really needed help, and the police department got about $40 million, and they spent a lot of that on overtime, on vehicles, ATVs, and this robot dog. So there was a lot of frustration at the time that, you know, people felt the money could have been spent more wisely. And that was backed up by a city audit as well in 2023, that some of the vehicles they bought had really low mileage at the time the audit was done, that they weren't really put to much use.
Well, it is our money, taxpayers' money, and we hope that
Indeed.
They can make better use of it. And yeah, we'll be looking for a follow-up.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks, Catherine.
All right. Thanks so much, Christina. We have been talking to Honolulu Civil Beat's Christina Jedra. You can look for her stories at civilbeat.org.
Join Hawaii Public Radio at Kahilu Theater on Friday, March 21st for a live taping of The Conversation at Kanikapila Sunday. We talk story with author and longtime Parker Ranch veterinarian Dr. Billy Bergen, UH biology professor Patrick Hart of Manu Minute, and Hilo singer-songwriter Kainane Kahaunaile. For more information, visit hprtickets.org, sponsored by Merriman's Restaurants and Big Island Coffee Roasters.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering a Master of Accounting program. Learn more at scheidler.hawaii.edu.
Arts funding amidst federal uncertainty. Tracking bills down at this week's crossover point is HPR's Cassie Ordonio. She joins us in studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so you've been tracking some bills down there. What's still alive or what's dead?
So we have three bills that are scheduled to be heard today for their the full vote in their chambers on the Senate and the House side. So bills that are still alive, Senate Bill 1581, and that bill would give money to the State Foundation on Culture and the Arts to create a Hawaii Japan Pacific Peace Monument. Right now, it's still too early in the session. We don't know how much is going to be appropriated, but the State Foundation is asking for money for that funding. To build that monument, it's in the context of this year marks the 80th anniversary of the end of World War II, and that monument would basically symbolize that relationship between Hawaii and Japan. Another bill that's also still alive is Senate Bill 441, and that would designate the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra as a state orchestra. This is also an appropriation bill. It would also, the original version of the bill would have funded $500,000 to the state orchestra for the next 2 years. Mm. I've done a story on it before. Apparently, it is normal for orchestras to get state funding. Another bill that's also still alive is House Bill 1378, and that would create a grants program under the foundation for artists to promote and execute performing arts in the state. Other bills that didn't make the cut would have created a Hawaii Leadership Awards program, and that would honor people who have made considerable and outstanding contributions. In Hawaii, another bill that didn't make the cut would have exempted renovations from having to set aside 1% of construction costs to the foundation's arts fund. So in Hawaii, Hawaii was the first in the state to pass a percent for arts law. So any new construction and renovations of building, 1% of that fund goes to the foundation's special fund.
Oh, yeah, and the artists were just excited about that because they thought, oh, gosh, this would be just a boost to our creative community.
Yeah, and it's also been on the chopping blocks before. When we covered it last session, there was a huge rally at the Capitol about it. But this bill also didn't make it this year. Another bill that also didn't make the cut that had the foundation really worried was Senate Bill 582. And on its surface, the bill would just transfer the foundation from one state agency to the other. Right now, the foundation is attached to the State Department of Accounting and General Services. And then it would actually be transferred over to DBED, so the Department of Economic Development and Tourism. But what the bill actually would have done is switch the funding from the arts agency salaries from special fund to general fund. And that basically gives lawmakers more direct control of how those funds are used. Some other programs and positions are also funded by federal funds as well. And these measures come while there's still uncertainty over federal funding. I've talked to Karen. They've been in conversation with the National Endowments for the Arts. That's where they get their funding. By law, arts agencies across the nation, they get 40% of that money from the NEA, which is supplied by Congress. And Karen Ewald, she's the executive director of the foundation. She was actually most worried about Senate Bill 582.
This destabilizes our funding, does not provide that backstop to positions or programs. And with the threat of reduced federal funding across all departments in the state, this amendment puts most of the SFCA positions and programs at risk of a reduction in force if there's a general fund shortfall. So we recommend striking that amendment and moving this forward by keeping the bill clean and straightforward. There is a study from the National Assembly of State Arts Agencies that has done a review of departments of agencies, state arts agencies, when they moved from department to department. And funding, the majority of these departments lose funding as they do that.
So she mentioned the National Assemblies of the State Arts Agencies, also known as NASA, and they keep track of how state arts agencies are doing across the nation. And NASA, they surveyed the agencies across the country that explored their placement within government. Many arts agencies are attached to state departments, and some arts agencies are attached to let's say, the Economic Development Authority and even the Department of Education in their own states. Ryan Stubbs, he is the Chief Program and Strategy Officer at NASA, and he said it varies by state whether arts agencies lose their funding when they switch departments.
It's not like we can say that being in a particular department in state government is going to be best for a state arts agency, but we do observe that when change happens and we compare the states that have undergone a change versus those that have not, there's a pretty wide disparity in just the aggregate appropriations for those agencies, right? So, you know, we have a chart here just showing states that have changed since 2002 even, and overall their appropriations have increased greater than 50%, whereas the combined agencies that did undergo some of the placement changes, their appropriations have declined a little bit. And we can look in the data a few different ways, right? And like the individual circumstances for the states will change. But overall, if a placement change is happening, what we see over the long term, it's not necessarily great for the overall budget health of the agency.
So really bottom line, though, is it looks like the foundation may have dodged a bullet.
Yeah, but then we're going to wait till next session.
All right. Okay. Well, thanks so much, Cassie. We've been talking to HVR's culture and arts reporter, Cassie Ordonio. Look for her stories on our website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Bond traders are worried about President Trump's proposed tax cuts and the ever-growing national debt.
The deficit is the Achilles heel of the Trump administration. And DOGE is going to try to get to $1 trillion of cuts. But when you look at the deficit and you look at the non-discretionary and discretionary spending, it's going to be very difficult.
So could the bond market be a check on Trump's agenda? That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2, following the world.
Piles of executive orders, major cuts to the federal workforce, brewing legal challenges, and shifts in foreign alliances. It's been a whirlwind first month of President Trump's second term. Now he'll address Congress and the nation, Trump's first major speech since Inauguration Day. I'm Ari Shapiro. Join us for live special coverage from NPR News.
Beginning this afternoon at 4.
Alok Vaidmenon has performed in more than 40 countries, but today marks the poet and comic's first show in Hawaii. Vaidmenon is non-binary and an advocate for laughter and joy amid much worry in the LGBT community under the Trump administration. The conversation's Mehdi Bender spoke with Vaidmenon, starting with a fit check.
I'm wearing a two-piece suit, not like in the formal kind and the fun kind. White, peppered with different fruits and flowers, because I'm kind of fruity.
Amazing. And I'm looking at your gorgeous nails, too, which are iridescent pink.
Yes, like kind of reflective, just to reflect back all the BS on people's faces.
To kind of go back in time to your childhood growing up, my friend was kind enough to lend me their copy of your little pocket book behind the gender binary, where you talk a little bit about growing up in a very rural, like country kind of place. When people think about folks who present outside the gender binary, there's a thought or misconception that it's only the college educated blue hair elites in the coastal cities. How was it untrue for you specifically?
I feel like blue-haired people get a bad rep.
They
and
do.
As someone who has dabbled in blue hair, I hate to tell you, I've met much freakier gingers than blue heads. Like, the subject of your ire is really misdirected. Yeah, you know, I think there's a misconception that trans and non-binary people are just elite, white, newfangled internet phenomenons, and that erases the fact that indigenous cultures, including Native Hawaiian cultures, have long acknowledged people outside of the gender binary for thousands of years. And so this weird thing happened where growing up in Texas, I didn't have the language to describe what I was. And had I grown up in India, I would have. And it actually took me becoming an adult and going back to India and meeting the millions of people there who live outside the gender binary, who are in fact acknowledged in state identity documents, have government reservation programs and formal recognition in a way that is far beyond the United States. So this idea that being non-binary is new is actually a colonial narrative. The truth is that there have always been people outside of the gender binary, but we were targeted by European colonists and forcibly assimilated into this idea of man versus woman. So what's new is not the existence of non-binary people. What's new is forcing billions of complex souls into one of two genders.
In many ways, your show at the Blue Note is sort of like an introduction to locals and people here. So how are you introducing yourself and introducing parts of the tour, mm-hmm. this leg of the tour?
Yeah, you know, I've been thinking a lot about what it means to perform in the U.S. now under a new administration. I'm just coming on the tails of a tour in Africa. I did Kenya, Namibia, Botswana, and South Africa, and then in Australia and New Zealand. And it felt so nice to be away from home and to comment on home from afar. So this is, in many ways, my first show back under the new administration. And my community is facing a lot of existential dread. I mean, it's just been a rampant escalation of really horrific executive orders and policies that are attempting to cordon off trans people from civic participation and public life. And there's a lot of grief. And I ask myself, like, why am I doing comedy when there's so much suffering? And then the answer is, I'm doing comedy because there's so much suffering. I believe that comedy is a spiritual practice of detoxifying and alchemizing painful things into less painful things. And I think comedy has always been a strategy that queer people have used to not just survive, but build meaningful and buoyant lives alongside so much intense harassment and discrimination. So I feel more called than ever to be funnier than ever.
I'm interested specifically in your comedic philosophy when we talk about politics, because comics have struggled trying to make Trump funny, mm-hmm. and even kind of the incursion of like laughter that's mostly people clapping because you're making a political point and they want to agree with you. So how do you be funny?
Clafter keeps haunting me everywhere I go. I don't know why. It is hard because here's the truth. We're not taught how to be funny in progressive movements. There's a way in which we have adopted a serious tone and a humorlessness that I actually feel is disadvantageous to what we want. Because what I understand is that we live in a dissociated world where people are separated from their bodies, and laughter is one of the first points of entry back into them. And so laughter is a somatic technology. It gets seen as something lowbrow, but I actually think it's a very sophisticated spiritual strategy of bringing people together in a room and them remembering at a physiological level how to be part of a crowd that's unified, not through fear and aggression, but through delight and curiosity. Where else do you have large masses of people come together for something good? And so I really feel the stakes and urgency as a comedian to be a choreographer of a different way of showing up, a different movement. And so what I notice in my audiences is sometimes I'm having to say, it's okay to laugh. People find things funny, but they're afraid of laughing. Mm. And I think it's a larger symptom of people are afraid of joy. There's a way in which a kind of puritanical nature has hit into our movements where we feel like if we're having a good time, then we're a sellout or we're complicit. As if our pleasure cancels out our ability to empathize and sympathize with the world. And I want to challenge that. And I want to say, actually, the only way that we can show up sincerely and sustainably is if we maintain a relationship with our pleasure and our delight. And it's taken me a while to come to this. I used to be one of those extremely serious political advocates who felt like comedy would sacrifice the advocacy that I was doing. And then I realized part of the architecture of the discrimination was forcing me to be serious, whenever actually that's not how I exist as a human being. I felt like I had to cosplay as a serious person and then go back to being funny with my friends. If I'm being bold, because why not? It's morning, let's give hot takes. I actually think that's why we got where we are, because we were dishonest about how we actually navigate the world. And people can read that dishonesty. So when we adopt seriousness publicly, but then intimately are funny as hell, we reek of that discrepancy. And so I know a lot of the most conscientious, empathetic, kind, sweet souls in my life are also some of the most ruthlessly dark and funny. And yet they're intimidated to express that part of themselves. And I just want to be a beacon that says, now is the time to show your crude humor. Now is the time to be superfluous and ridiculous. And what you'll find is that that creates space for us to come together again.
You are trans non-binary. You feel like people want to erase or otherwise marginalize trans non-binary voices. And so what you do for a living is get up on stage and have lights focus on you and a microphone and shout as loud as you can. Would you have done that anyway, or is some of what you do in contrast to what people might want you to do?
You know, that's actually one of the subjects I'm exploring in the show, is I've never been able to really disentangle my self-concept from being projected on by other people. Some of my earliest memories were people levying slurs at me, and those slurs were how I discovered who I was. It was not an organic process of I am. It was another process of, yikes, what is this? Panic, anxiety, fear were the first ingredients with which I had to concoct myself through. And so I question all the time, am I a performer because this is the only place in culture people are comfortable with someone like me, or because I want to be here? And what I've come to the conclusion, thank goodness for being non-binary, is it's a bit of both, and I will never be able to separate the two. And there's a pain and there's a glee in that. And knowing that I'm here because it's one of the only spaces where I could wear what I wanted to wear. Imagine if I tried to be a diplomat or a business person. People would have a lot of issues with my fake lashes. But on stage, for some reason, it's one of the few spaces where I'm allowed to be and to exist. And in that way, I think a tension that always haunts my work is, why do you only see me in a performance context? Why don't you see me next to you on the street or at a restaurant? Why are you more comfortable when you're laughing at me and not when we're just hanging out or being? And I actually find that to be so funny. I used to find it really sad, and now I find it so funny. And so I play around with it, you know? Like, I make jokes like, you were going to laugh at me in the street anyway, so I figured I might gather you in a room and charge you for it. There's ways to acknowledge that dynamic and to show that I'm aware of it. And I think I take a lot of my lessons here from the history of Indigenous comedy, from the history of Black comics, disabled comics, people who have always had this uneasy tension of, what does it mean to be joking whenever the minute we step out of the comedy club? It's very painful.
That was Alok Bidemenon speaking with HBR's Maddie Bender. The comic and poet performs two shows tonight at the Blue Note in Waikiki, one at 6:30, the other at 9.
When you support HPR, you support classical music and all its benefits.
Melvin Yee, neurologist here in Honolulu, longtime HPR member, your love for guitar that you're sharing for us tonight on our evening concert.
What I always tell my patients who are worried about their cognitive ability as they age, that one should always try to keep your mind active.
There are many studies about the health benefits of music on your health and well-being.
Yes, it's very peaceful and calming. And then when I play the guitar, I can just focus on that, forget all the other concerns, and just work on playing the music.
Support classical music on HPR. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
This month, Kumuhula Patrick Makuakani debuts an album that brings his San Francisco halau and band to Oahu. The San Francisco Troupe celebrates its 40th year, and there are a number of shows planned for the year. The MacArthur Genius Grant awardee dropped by our studio last week to talk about what's in store.
We're really getting ready for our March 15th and 16th show at Leeward Community College. It's called Kupu Kupu, and it sort of celebrates the band that I have called Kupu Kupu, and the name of the album is called Kupu Kupu, so why not call the show Kupu Kupu? It's Kupu Kupu for everyone.
Okay, all right. And this is part of your celebration for the 40th anniversary of your halau.
Yeah, we turned 40 years old this year. That means one thing, I'm old. It's 40 years. It's a long time. So, yes, this is part of it.
Tell us about the show and what our listeners and the folks who will be coming out to support you can expect.
Well, if you have seen our shows in the past, you know that it's sort of Hawaiian. Well, it's very Hawaiian, and it's kind of, a few innovative, modern kind of developments and twists and turns. But we really, foundationally, I feel that we are Hawaiian, and it grows from that place. And this is my band that I'm coming out with an album of the same name. So the music, a lot of it is in Hawaiian, but it's given a more sort of a contemporary treatment. Yeah, if you kind of like what we do with our shows, then hopefully you'll like the album. If you don't like our shows, then you won't like the album.
Well, you have been a busy man because you were here, last month with the premiere of the show in Waikiki.
Correct, yes. I have been to Hawaii in the last year probably more than I have ever been back and forth to Hawaii. And, I love it. I love coming home. What a treat for me to be here. My halau's not too happy because I haven't been teaching hula, but it's no better excuse than to be in Hawaii. But yes, we've been launching the show, The Return of Kapai Mahu, and I didn't realize that it was going to be so challenging to acquire dancers, for the show. But we managed to get some really great ones, and so we are ready, and we have been performing it for a few weeks now, and it's going really well. So I'm here to dance one more show, and then I'm back in the city, and it's all theirs.
And we had a conversation before because you were talking about how you were kind of proud that you were able to secure some decent funding to pay our dancers.
Absolutely. Thank you for bringing that up because, our show is not a corporate-run show. It's not run by a business entity or a hotel, right, where there's a lot of funding. And normally, and I will say this, in a show, the musicians get a pretty good deal, and the person who's the last on the rung are the dancers. So I wanted to ensure that this is a dancer show. We have no musicians, everything's on track, and that was intentional, so that the dancers can shine. They are the true storytellers, and I wanted to make sure that they have an equitable pay scale. So I really worked hard to pay them well, and they should be paid well. I was a dancer in Waikiki at the Royal Hawaiian Hotel and at the Cinerama Reef, and I know there's lots of hula dancers out there on the strip, and I want us to be known as the show that pays the dancers the best. So there you have it.
Okay. Well, I think it's that acknowledgement.
Yes, absolutely. Right. Hula dancers haven't been acknowledged that way as a really important integral part of a show, and therefore, equitably, they should be, the payment scale should reflect that.
One big deal this year was the opening of Awana, and that is going to be a regular thing, which is terrific.
Yes, it is terrific, right.
And so, it does, elevate dance and music and the history.
Right. Yes, absolutely. And I I'm not sure what they're paying, but I'm sure they're paying pretty well.
But the idea is that there's opportunity.
Well, absolutely. Yes, there is opportunity, right? Although the dancing, and I love the dancing because my hula sister, Hiva Vaughn, is the choreographer for that show, and I owe her a great deal because she gave me four of her dancers for my show.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, and they provide a really lovely nucleus for the group. But yes, that's a Cirque show, so the main acts are the circus acts, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You know, but where ours is, the main act is the dancing. It's the hula and the story.
Well, okay, and you are a busy man. You've got this album that will roll out to coincide with your show at Leeward, but you also have a few other things in your back pocket.
A few things, yes. Like you said, it's our 40th anniversary, so we have an entire halal recital in June at this really wonderful place in San Francisco called the Yerba Buena Gardens, and every summer, it's the Yerba Buena Gardens Festival, and it's like an oasis in the middle of downtown San Francisco. It's quite lovely, and it's on Indian land, the Ramatush Ohlone people. So we're doing a kind of commemorative to our Indian brothers and sisters, and then our show deals with aloha aina, just a love for the land, yeah, and patriotism. And all 400 of my students will be dancing. Okay, maybe 380.
Okay.
We'll see. We'll see everybody. Yeah, so we're looking forward to that. That's in June. And then in August, Robert Casimero, who is my kumu, his halal, which is my halal, is celebrating their 50th anniversary. Their 50th year of all-male halal hula. And we're going to be dancing with them because it's our 40th, so it's like a legacy show. That's what we're calling it. Yeah, all guys. Back to hula, all guys. That's where I grew up, dancing hula. That's in August.
The first week of August.
Yeah. And that's at the Presidio Theater, which is our new theater. But you know, President Trump pulled funds from the Presidio Trust.
Oh,
so,
yes.
Yeah, or trying to, so we'll see. Yeah, we will not be affected. Yes, and then lastly, to celebrate and commemorate our 40th year, we have a show called Le'a Le'a, which is what I'm terming the Naughty Nale Hulu Show. It's a show that is specifically for adults only, adult-themed show.
A little racy.
Very racy. Yeah, can't wait. Should be a lot of fun.
And you have also been working on a musical?
Yes, a musical, right? It's a musical based on the epic tale of Hi'iaka Ikapoliopele. We've been doing that for a long time now, and it's finally coming to fruition. And it's supposed to be opening as part of a workshop in October of this year in Ventura. So, yes, we're heading for that. And eventually, we'd like to get it up and running in Hawaii next year sometime.
Well, you know, when we talked before the pandemic, right, you had some discussions with the cruise lines that you were trying to put something together,
yes,
right?
Yes, right. Yeah, and of course, you know, they'll put the kibosh on that when that first cruise ship was detained and all that whole fiasco happened. So, yeah, there's no cruise ship, and I'm kind of happy about that. Because we really ideally would like the show to open in Hawaii for Hawaii's people. And I have a grand idea about how we're going to have a smart and engaging cultural and educational component that's attached to the show. So when you come and see the show, it's not going to be like, all right, everybody, stand up and you get to learn a hula. It's like, no, that's okay. Sit down, relax.
Mm-hmm.
Learn about the culture in a way that's, you know, the way that we understand our culture, coming from a native Hawaiian perspective. And that's what I'm really thrilled about. I mean, of course, I'm thrilled about the show. But the cultural and educational component that will be attached to the show is, for me, just as important.
You have just been incredibly busy. I don't know where you get your energy. But you shared with me that you were recently an artist in residence at Grace Cathedral?
Yes, this year I'm the artist in residence at Grace Cathedral. I believe Bobby McFerrin was last year or the year before. And I don't know, have you ever been to Grace Cathedral?
Yes.
It's pretty remarkable.
Beautiful.
Right? And what's remarkable about Grace Cathedral, they're quite progressive because I'm a well-known pagan. And they're letting me in that church. And I'm doing some really amazing things in the church. They're just letting me connect in ways that is resonant to me. Like, for instance, one of the coolest things they're going to let me do is create a kuahu, or an altar, or a place to acknowledge for us in hula. Our kuahu is to acknowledge the hula deities, Laka, Kapo, or Hi'iaka. And the idea with a kuahu is you create this beautiful structure with the plants, vines, and blossoms and fragrances from the forest to entice the akua to come and sit on that kuahu for the purpose of inspiring you to be the best hula dancer you can be. How lovely is that, right?
Mm.
And so they have this amazing picture, I believe the artist's name is David LaChapelle, of the Virgin Mary in this beautiful garden. And when they first told me about it, well, maybe you'd like to put the kuahu by the David LaChapelle image. And I was like, oh, okay, whatever. Let me see it. Oh my God, yes. It's perfect. Yeah, so I'm going to bring that picture out of the wall into the church and then decorate this entire area in a Hula-esque Kauai fashion, glorious way. So yeah, super excited. So another thing I'm doing is I'm going to be working with the Cathedral School for Boys and Girls on teaching them some stuff, and I'm going to teach them all the Mauna Kea chants, teach them all about that so that, you know, they have an idea of what's going on here in Hawaii as far as a mountain is concerned. And I also just recently did a preview of our Hiiaka musical, and I brought in the other creative, Roz Katrakia, who wrote all the songs.
Oh, she's awesome.
Roz, she is the freaking bomb. I love her so much. And Jana Alkane, who is our lead character playing Hiiaka, and she's phenomenal. And so we sang a few songs and talked a little bit about the play and the musical, what people could expect. And we were sitting, like, they arranged it so that we were on the pulpit, right? And it was... wow, you kind of feel, yeah, I never felt so holy in my life. Will the walls start crumbling down?
No, that was the irrepressible, irreverent, and incredibly innovative Patrick Makuakani. He was talking about the many projects he's involved in as we mark the 40th anniversary of his Halau Na Le Hulu Ika Vekiu. Makuakani shared that last month something spiritual happened following their event at Grace Cathedral in San Francisco. In our previous conversations with him, he had shared that last year his halau danced for Roberta Flack, who died a week ago from ALS. Roberta Flack's manager, Suzanne Koga, is from Hawaii, and she had extended the invite for them to go to New York to perform their hula to the song "The First Time I Ever Saw Your Face." It is a classic.
The first ever I saw your face.
Makuakani tells us that he'd been sending video clips of encouragement to Roberta Flack, including one at the cathedral.
We're thinking about you, we're sending all our love. It's just a little bit of something that we're here in Grace Cathedral. There's a few people who want to say hello to you. We love you! We love you! We sent it in to Suzanne on Sunday morning. And then after we sent it, about 2 hours later, Suzanne sent me a picture of Roberta watching it. On the big screen, you can see her feet, and she's watching the big screen TV, and she says, I was saying how much she just loved it. You can feel all the love from the TV at Grace Cathedral. And then we found out that she died the next morning. So Suzanne told me that it was her last standing ovation. Just kind of gets you, because she's what an artist, and to be able to afford some kind of like relief or love at the end of this, her story for right now, you know, it's like it brings me so much joy.
That was Patrick Makuakani playing tribute to singer Roberta Flack, who died a week ago.
Ever I kissed your mouth.
Well, that wraps it up for us today. Tomorrow, we talk with Maui County Mayor Richard Bisson, and we take a look at food insecurity in the state. Share your comments or questions about what you heard by calling our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.
Okay.